From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. A crisis hotline, mobile teams that travel to residents in distress. Just some of the services provided by the nonprofit Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated. Executive Director Edgar Wiggins describes how BCRI helps city residents living with mental illness or substance abuse, and how they train police to de-escalate stressful situations. Its approach is to meet people where they are rather than issuing ultimatums.
If you think about how disenfranchised some of these folks are, you don't want to say, well, we're going to get you in a treatment bed, because that may not be the first thing that they want or need. How about a hot cup of coffee? How about a meal? Do you have a place to stay?
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Spending a night in jail does little to help someone suffering in a mental health or substance abuse crisis. And someone in distress who comes in contact with the police can face dire consequences if officers do not recognize their behavior and respond calmly. The nonprofit Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated is hard at work educating police about mental illness and addiction, while also providing services to the public that range from a crisis hotline and mobile crisis teams to case management and medical detoxification. Edgar Wiggins is the founder and executive director of Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated, which opened its doors in 1992. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
Who does Baltimore Crisis Response serve?
Anyone and everyone. We are part of the public behavioral health system in Baltimore, and as such, as a nonprofit organization that provides services, we are mission-driven. So anyone that calls our hotline can talk about the services that are available and access those services.
In a way, the police are clients of yours too, right? Because you provide training for police.
Oh, sure. Our relationship with the police department goes back to 2004. We've had a training relationship with them, and essentially what we try to do is to equip officers to be more effective when dealing with someone in a behavioral health crisis. And that helps officers in terms of being able to engage people.
Yeah, I want to ask you more about that training and how you can impart that. But let me ask a more basic thing first. Why not just address mental illness or substance abuse disorder? Why tackle both?
Well, this is Baltimore City. And one of the things that we have found is that there are a high percentage of individuals who wind up in crisis who have what we call comorbid conditions or a co-occurring disorder. Sometimes people that have mental illnesses self-medicate with substances, both alcohol and illicit drugs. So it's hard to know really what you're getting when someone's in crisis. There are a group of people that we work with who have primarily addictions and substance abuse problems. But if I looked at our data in terms of the number of people that we encounter and serve in any given year, 75% of those people have comorbid conditions.
They're dealing both with a mental health issue
mental
and
health
a substance
issue,
abuse issue
and a substance abuse issue. Now, the national data on that is a little bit lower, but even nationally, when we look at behavioral health concerns, we find that probably 45 to 50% of people that go into crisis have both disorders.
I mentioned some of the services that Baltimore Crisis Response provides: a crisis hotline, case management. If someone comes to BCRI for treatment for mental illness or substance abuse disorder, where do you get the resources to provide treatment?
First of all, as part of the public behavioral health system, we rely to a great extent on state mental health and federal block grant funds.
Block grants.
Yes. So that's some of where our resources come from. We also have contracts for services, and we also get fees for services because, as you know, 25% of the people that live in Baltimore City live at the poverty level or below. So they qualify for services by the public behavioral health system. Many of the people that we serve have Medicaid and Medicare. And so those kinds of things are really, really helpful getting paid.
Mm-hmm. But I get the impression you find a way to get the services or the treatment that people need. You find how they fit into some source of funding.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's very important for us. The other thing that's important to realize is we are the only organization that goes out to see people previously unknown to us who are in crisis. So it's not like you come to our building. Our mobile crisis teams come to you.
And tell me more about these mobile crisis teams.
Well, our mobile crisis teams, they're two-person teams, and they are comprised of a licensed mental health clinician and a nurse. Why a registered nurse as part of the team? Well, one of the things that we know going back to Baltimore being a poor city is that, you know, poor people, people that are living at the poverty level or below, aren't seeing their family doctor. So sometimes what we see are people who have significant somatic conditions. So we're talking about mental health, substance abuse, and somatic conditions. A lot of the common disorders that one would expect, diabetes, hypertension, sometimes people with HIV or full-blown AIDS, hepatitis, all of these things. So it's important for our teams to be able to do an accurate assessment of all of the things that are going into contributing to that person's crisis.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Edgar Wiggins, Executive Director of Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated. It's a nonprofit that provides services to people with mental health and substance abuse disorders, in addition to training police to recognize signs of mental illness and de-escalate situations with people in crisis. Another facet of BCRI is educating police. Is this training offered when someone is new to the academy or after officers have had some time on the streets?
The training has gone through an evolution. We started out in 2004 with experienced patrol officers, and then after a while it was challenging for the department to take 25 officers off the street for a week-long training. So we moved into the academy for a few years and got officers right before they were about to graduate. But as a result of numerous things having to do with the unrest and the resulting DOJ investigation and now a consent decree, the department has gone back to the original model, which is for us to train experienced patrol officers. My preference, in fact, is to do that. It makes much more sense, as far as I'm concerned, to work with experienced officers who've had time on the street, who've encountered people in crisis, and to try to help them improve their skills. Now, that's one facet. We also, however, are doing a brief introductory training with cadets while they're in the academy, just to familiarize them with some of the concepts.
And how do you help officers understand how mental illness impairs someone's judgment?
Well, it's a week-long training. It's very intense. And the way that we have designed it is that the modules build on each other. So, for instance, I spend a lot of time talking about things like understanding mental illness. This is extremely important so that officers are able to begin to recognize the signs and symptoms of somebody with a mental illness, a substance abuse disorder, who's in acute crisis. We also have some of our partners come in, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, for instance. They do an exercise called Virtual Voices, where officers get to wear headphones and experience what it's like to have auditory hallucinations. I spend a significant amount of time talking about working with someone in a suicidal crisis, because that's often another particular situation which officers encounter. There are a number of partners involved in the training. The local behavioral health authority has actually inserted a trainer, a very experienced, licensed clinical social worker, in the academy. So she works on de-escalation techniques. So as things go on, each module builds.
As you pointed out, you've had this partnership with the Baltimore Police Department since 2004.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, the Department of Justice issued its report on police practices in the city and noted that 20% of the use of force files which BPD presented to federal investigators involved individuals with mental health disabilities or in crisis. 1 out of 5 use of force cases, which raises the question, is the training working?
Well, we know it is now. One of the things that we have done is, in addition to collecting our own data, we've got researchers from Johns Hopkins who are talking with officers, who are doing focus groups, who are looking at changes in attitudes, who are asking questions before the training, like, did you feel capable in terms of recognizing and working with somebody in crisis? And generally the response you get is no. Now there's a much higher level of comfort in terms of being able to engage people. We're also getting some preliminary indications that the use of force is decreasing, so that officers are learning that you can talk to people, you can engage people, you can de-escalate people with words, you can get people to cooperate and comply. There are ways that you approach people in crisis rather than, you know, issuing commands. Come in and try and engage them. Hello, my name is Officer Wiggins. And you are... And what's going on? Can you tell me about what's going on? Getting officers to be able to take the time to reflect and feedback what people are telling them.
We have to take a quick break here on the record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, I'll ask Edgar Wiggins, Executive Director of Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated, how a jail diversion program being piloted in downtown Baltimore is shifting the focus from arrest to treatment. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Last February, the Baltimore Police Department began a pilot program in which some individuals stopped for minor drug offenses were given the choice of connecting to services and treatment rather than jail. It's called the LEAD program. That's Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. It operates in the western half of downtown. LEAD is one way Baltimore is addressing the opioid overdose epidemic. In the first 9 months of last year, Baltimore saw 523 deaths from prescription and illicit opioids. Edgar Wiggins is with me. He is founder and executive director of Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated. Edgar Wiggins, how do people get connected to your services through the LEAD program?
So what we have been working with the officers from the Central District on is diverting individuals from low-level drug crimes and giving them an opportunity to participate in services. Now, I choose my words carefully. I said services. I didn't say treatment. LEAD operates from a harm reduction model. And this is a concept that is extremely important for people to understand. Officers who observe a person engaging in a crime have an opportunity to talk with them, take them into custody, and then give them an option. You can go to jail, or you can get involved with these services. They have to run that individual's background to make sure that there are no outstanding warrants and that kind of stuff, to make sure that they're eligible. But what LEAD tries to do is to begin not only to engage in a relationship with that person, but begin to meet that person's needs. If you think about how disenfranchised some of these folks are, you don't want to say, well, we're going to get you in a treatment bed, because that may not be the first thing that they want or need. How about a hot cup of coffee? How about a meal? Do you have a place to stay? Those kinds of things. So the LEAD team, that group of case managers and clinicians who work with the police department, engage people, essentially do an assessment of where they are and then try to begin to meet those needs. Now, eventually, one of the things that we'd like to see is for the person to get engaged in treatment, but we don't want to start there because we know that often doesn't work. But if you can help the person meet their needs, if you can get them off the street, if you can get them a hot meal, if you can get them clothes, some shelter, those kinds of things, then you can start to move down the list. But harm reduction, this model basically says, hey, if I'm a drug addict and I'm using drugs every day of the week, that's not good. But with harm reduction, if I can suddenly be only using drugs 2 days a week, that's a success. That's not to be poo-pooed. That's really a success. That's harm reduction. Eventually, we hope to get the people in treatment. We've seen some successes with this approach. We didn't invent it. Seattle was one of the first LEAD sites. So fortunately, we were able to learn from their successes and their mistakes.
How many people have participated?
We've had 130 people come through LEAD. At this point, we've got an active caseload of about 50 participants.
And tell me about some of them.
So last April, a University of Maryland officer approached a vulnerable man and asked if he needed assistance. The man was shy, had difficulty moving and speaking. The officer offered a referral to LEAD, believing from his observation that the individual had an alcohol use disorder. Engagement was difficult, and we have peer specialists. Now, I want to highlight the role of a peer specialist. A peer specialist is somebody who's walked in that individual's shoes. We have a wonderful young man who works with us who was able to develop a strong relationship with this person. He was then able to find that the individual had a Huntington's disease diagnosis. That peer specialist was able to get the individual in the Johns Hopkins Clinic, where he received high-quality long-term care to help him manage his symptoms.
Huntington's disease is a neurological
Yes.
disorder, progressive disorder.
Right. And so one of the things we were able to do once he got medical care, we were then able to get him permanently housed. And this all took a few weeks. So here's somebody that we got off the street into high quality medical care and also got his alcoholism under control.
That's Edgar Wiggins, executive director of the nonprofit Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated, which provides case management for individuals in the LEAD program and array of other services. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We talked a bit about mobile crisis teams. Specifically, where do they work?
We have a facility in West Baltimore, which I'm very proud of saying after 25 years in this job, we finally bought a building. So we have a permanent home. In that facility, that's where all of our services are located. So the hotline is there.
24-hour hotline.
Yes, our 24-hour hotline is there.
What is that number, by the way?
410-433-5100. 4107575, and it's available 24 hours a day.
410-433-5175. I'll say it again at the end of the interview, and we'll put it on the record page at WIPR.org.
So in that facility, 24-hour mobile crisis teams are dispatched from there, but also in the building, we have residential services. So we currently operate 21 what we call crisis beds. This is short-term residential treatment for people who are in crisis. It is very much like a hospital, except it's voluntary. Individuals have access to around-the-clock nursing services, regular supportive counseling. They are seen by one of our doctors every day. Our average length of stay is about 9 or 10 days. The goal is to get them stable and then move them on to the next level of care. The other residential program that we provide in that facility are medically monitored detox beds, or what we call withdrawal management beds. And this is where we treat people who are going into withdrawal from benzodiazepines, alcohol, and opiates. That's a short-term length of stay. It's averages about 7 days. And our goal for that service is to help people safely and effectively manage their withdrawal symptoms. But then we want to refer them to the next level of care for ongoing substance abuse and addictions treatment.
You started Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated 26 years ago, in the early 90s.
Just about. Mm-hmm. 92. Yep.
How have you seen attitudes about mental health and substance abuse disorder change?
I believe that while some attitudes have changed, I think stigma is still a significant challenge for both disorders. I think it's difficult for people to often recognize that these are diseases. These are brain disorders. There's a tremendous amount of public education that needs to occur about these illnesses so that we put them in the proper perspective of illness. The more we can educate people, the more attitudes change. And a lot of times attitudes only change through knowing somebody. I mean, that's what we found. Just to go back to talking about training police, attitudes with police officers change because, you know, I'll often have somebody take me aside during one of the breaks in training and say, you know, there's mental illness in my family. There's substance abuse in my family. So these aren't things that happen to others. These are things that happen to us. And that's what people need to get.
You describe an array of ways of trying to meet people where they are, especially when they might be in crisis. And yet, I think people who know Baltimore would say, you know, this is a city of so much trauma and so many people in crisis. Are you making a dent?
Well, we know we're making a dent. It's one person at a time kind of dent. One of the things that I think is very challenging for people that do the kind of work that we do is that you have to celebrate victories, because the work can be overwhelming. But I also know, I'll tell you, I was on the board of a local theater group, and they had a session where people that were living with behavioral health conditions had these very revealing kinds of talks. It was a wonderful night. And so they asked me to do a talk back after it was done. So we're having a discussion, and then it was time to break for, you know, soda and pizza. Guy walked up to me, tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I said, "No, sir, I'm sorry, I don't." And I very quickly did the scan, and I thought, boy, he had some nice pressed jeans on. I'd wear those jeans. Those boots are slamming. They're great. That's a pretty nifty leather jacket. So I do the scan. And he said, "I was in your detox program 5 years ago." And I said, "You were?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I got a job, taking care of my mama. I bought a house, and I just want to thank you. I said, you did the work. I didn't do the work, but I could have fallen over this guy and not known him. And that gave me a lift for a week. Some guy who knew me, I didn't know him. And as you do the work, that's where you've got to get your gratification from. Because, I mean, you know, there are things that don't work out. There are lots and lots of failures. There are lots of challenges. But when you can celebrate the successes, these are people's lives that we're talking about. You know, sometimes I'll be sitting at my desk trying to figure out the latest administrative nightmare. And I'm just like, get up. You're not going to solve this right now. And get up from behind my desk. I go up to one of the patient floors, and I'll just hang out in a group for half an hour. And I see how what we're doing is making a difference. And those are the numbers that I need to count.
Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Edgar Wiggins is founding executive director of the nonprofit Baltimore Crisis Response Incorporated. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we will link to that site. The 24-hour hotline number is 410-433-5175, 410-433-5175. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.